Documentaries.
Uh-huh.
History. Insights. Interviews. Chef's Deep Dive.
Welcome to Chef's Deep Dive. We've got a brand new guest. He's never been on before. He's a guest host on the Proctor Who. He's on Take Your Seats. He's on Trek This Out. He's the podcast messiah. It's Sucky Cack.
Podcast messiah, where the hell do you get that from, man?
Well, I have like John Podcast King and then Bob the Podcast Master, so now, you just fell under messiah.
Bob's nickname for me is Podcast Whore, right? So that's that's what you should have said. That's what it was.
You'd rather be known as a whore than the messiah.
Well, no, well, no. There's all sorts of connotations with a messiah. I don't want the expectations with that. Whereas with a whore, you know exactly what I am.
Yeah, brilliant. I hope your family don't listen to this.
No, they don't bother listening to me when I'm in the room.
So how are you doing, Sucky?
I'm doing okay. I'm looking forward to this. All right, big Stan and Ollie fan I am.
Oh, I love them. Absolutely, for years. And I'm so glad. Like, I did a list bloody nearly a year ago now of all the films I wanted to do. Yeah. But the trouble is, you must have it as well with you Take Your Seats, is you want to do certain films, but people keep coming on doing films you want to do. So you never get around to do them. So I was so glad when you said you'll do a Laurel and Hardy one. I was like, yes!
Well, the list that you sent me said, do you want to fancy any of these? And the only one that stood out was Laurel and Hardy. I mean, they were all the stuff on there was very good. But being a Laurel and Hardy fan, I thought, yes, that's the one I want to do. And I thought, okay, yeah, thank you very much, Clifford.
Well, I had to say, Laurel and Hardy, to me, just a quick rundown is, reminds me of my granddad coming to babysit myself and my brother. You see, my dad had worked shifts, and my mum worked later on in the afternoon. So sometimes we'll get home from school, and my granddad used to sit us there, and we'll watch Laurel and Hardy. I think it was BBC Two.
Yeah, BBC Two.
BBC Two, and we used to watch them again and again because you used to just repeat them, didn't they, constantly? Yeah. Oh, and it always harpers back, remembering my granddad. And this one, I remember him because he got up and did the little dance. He used to do the dance with him.
The dance at the beginning, where they entered the saloon. Yeah, that's class.
It's class.
So brilliant, that is. But you don't expect them to do that, but it just happens. But I've got the same sort of memories as you have. But it was always, BBC Two would show, like, Stan and Ollie, there'd be Chaplin on there sometimes, Keaton on there. Well, not that much Keaton, but there would be Harold Lloyd was the other big one, right, that we used to watch from the silent era, and they'd always have them on BBC Two at around about 6 o'clock. So after you just come out from school, you've had something to eat, you've gone out, had some to play, and then you're back indoors, and you sit there and you just watch these classics. And they were brilliant. They were only 20 minutes long, but you sit there because it was so funny. And these pair, perfect. I mean, you got Ollie as the know-it-all buffoon and Stan as the poor, naive little put-upon simpleton, basically. And they just gelled together. They were just brilliant.
It's the perfect comedy duo. And I think they're the best comedy duo of all time. Without these, you probably wouldn't have got other comedy duos which came after. Like, do you remember Bing Crosby and Bob Hope did a series of films?
Yeah, the Route 2
movies. Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis did a series of films. But they played the same character but different names. These two always played the same character, kept their own name, and in different situations.
Yeah, the only people that you could come close to that was Abbott and Costello.
Exactly, right.
Abbott and Costello, they did their, but their personas were slightly antagonistic towards each other. They just hate, they got on, but they didn't get on. Right, whereas exactly. these two, you yeah. can see the love between them, even though half the plans that Ollie makes is always scuppered by poor Stan, right? But there's always love between them, right? And you can see it in the way they perform. And they were like best mates anyway, right?
They were best mates in real life.
Yeah, after they were partnered together, they were best mates for years and years. And you know, when Ollie died, poor Ollie died, right? Stan really never made a film after this. Right, so he carried on writing, but never really made a film. And you just think, if they'd have been more well-loved after their initial period where they were doing all the shorts and before they went into the big pictures, when they made longer ones, that would have been even bigger. Because they were forgotten.
Oh, it's they was forgotten for a long time, because you got to think, you know, when people say that Hollywood golden age, well, if you actually look at it, it was an absolute cesspool of rigid contracts, and you was more or less bought and sold between, different production outfits. So like Hal Roach, the one who picked these up and more or less put them together, you know, the producer and that. He had such a hard time with Stan as well, because Stan really wanted his name because of all the editing, all the directing, all the writing he did. And I believe he has got his name to this one, The Way Out West, but as more or less a side note, because actually underneath, embedded, it says still Hal Roach Studios production.
Well, you know the story behind Stan. Stan was the creative behind the duo. Yeah. He was the one that wrote, he was the one that directed, came up with the gags, whereas Ollie would just like to play most of his time on a golf course somewhere.
Yeah, right, so yeah, he didn't
gambling on the horses, gambling on whatever he wanted to do. Right, so basically Stan was paying for both of them, but Stan was doing all the work. And he got the producer's credit on a lot of the shorts, which meant that it was a production, but that was all he was credited with, even though he did virtually everything.
Yeah. And then they kind of look it in the sense that Hal Roach was so, such a bit of a Scrooge-type character, because without him and his push and drive to keep these on TV in the 50s and push into the 60s and 70s, they would have just disappeared. Because very luckily, Hal Roach lived to about, I think it was about 100 years old. So even then, he was constantly trying to push these out. And he was one of the first ones to adopt a colorization. Because Way Out West was coloured in around 85, 86.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Terrible. He was one of the ones to try and keep them in the light. The public, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you think about it. The BBC bought all these silent and comedies that all the silent era did, and the ones in the shorts that they did afterwards when the sounds came. They bought all these for these early evening slots and for when the school holidays as well. During the school holidays, they'd be put on in the mornings as well. So you'd be able to watch them in the mornings. So the BBC kept them in the public eye in the UK. In America, they were cheap for all the public stations, right? Because they'd go, we need someone to fill this the airtime. Okay, we've got a load of all these black and white comedies. How about this? Buy them in bulk. And they'd buy them in bulk, and they'd be on all the while. That's what they kept them all. And it's the only way they managed to get back into the public eye.
I was going to say, it's also massively international, easy to sell, because my wife's Iranian, and she says she remembers Laurel and Hardy being on. She remembers Buster Keaton being on. Yeah. Because anything silent is so easy to sell abroad. Yeah. Yeah. That's why Mr. Bean now still does well, because it's so easy to sell off to a different country.
Easy. The Stan Laurel comedy shorts, which are made in sound, they were also made in German, Spanish, and Italian. Did you know that? Right, so this is one of the most strangest things I'd heard from back in this era. So you'd have the English version all made, done, and then they'd film it again using German language, and then film it again using Italian language. Right, it's just weird. So if you bought the 21 disc box set that came out, I think about 15, 20 years ago, whatever it was, right? Yeah. They would have it on there. You'd have your black and white original version. You'd have your colorized version. And then occasionally they'd have the Italian version, they have the German version on there, and you can watch these different versions of all this stuff. It's just weird seeing that.
There's a brilliant picture, and I tried to find it for the picture of this podcast, but there's one where there's Ollie reading the lines, and there's someone stood behind Stan with a chalkboard in Spanish writing, or, you know, phalletic writing?
I know what you mean.
Type of understand and say it himself, because I believe they did that for a while until to the point where it just got too much, and then after that people, you know, overdubbed it in the future.
Oh, they might have done that. I mean, I can understand them getting them having to do the same sort of thing but in different languages. It probably got frustrating for all of them.
Yeah, especially can you imagine the management, how well should just say, no, it's still the same one. We've done it four times. No, you're getting paid for one. So I can imagine it's going to be that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it could do. But it might be a bit later on, Hal Roach realised he could probably make the English version and then get a dub and just bang a dub on, right, to make it so much cheaper.
And it's so family funny. You could watch them at any age, and there's nothing on there where, you know, you could watch Netflix now, and literally I could be watching Netflix and be like, oh, that's a bit risque for the kids or something like that. Lola Nardi, anytime, just you put them watch, in front of it.
You definitely watch this at any age. I mean, I've got nephews and nieces, actually no, I've got my kids, right, basically, and I've got them watching Lauren Hardy in the past, and they've sat there and watched it and they've laughed all the way through. But because Lauren Hardy isn't on the telly these days at all, my nephews and nieces, the only way they can watch it is when they come in, and if I've got a video, a DVD downstairs, right, I can bang it on and say, look, just watch one of these and see what they say. I've only managed to do it with two of my nephews, and they've watched it for half an hour, whatever, and then they've walked away and go, I'm going to play football in the garden. They've enjoyed it, but then they'd rather be playing football in the garden.
It is hard though to try and break that that view of watching something in black and white. As a child growing up, I'm used to watching black and white, the old films. There was always a John Mills film on a Sunday. There was, you know what I mean? There was always something black and white you was watching. But now, like, I remember my eldest son, Cyrus, when he was only about 5 or 6, and I switched on something black and white, and he turned to me and says, is it black and white? Because it was black and white back then.
Yes, we all went round looking at
what happened.
What colour trousers shall I wear today? That black one, or shall I wear that white one?
Be a bit risque, be a bit of grey.
Yes, oh, kids, bless them.
The way out west, let me just give you some figures on here. I think, so it was 1937 that it came out. And they call it a feature film, a long film, but their film has never lasted more than an hour 10, an hour 5, something like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Probably because of how budget reasons want it. They tried to keep the budget as low as they can so they can pump it out to as many other places as well. It also nearly won an Oscar. For the music.
Yeah, for the music, yes. I heard that. I mean, the music's great, isn't it? I mean, I'm not even a music fan, but you listen to the opening dance little thing that they did, right, Stan and Ollie, where they come up to the saloon, right? That's fantastic. And then they had that little ditty in the saloon itself.
The Lonesome Pine.
Yeah, Lonesome Pine.
Right. Which was a hit. 1975 was number 2 in the UK charts.
Yes. I just love it. I mean, I remember that being played when I was a kid all the while, and I'd listen to it. And I'd, after a bit, you just get to know the words.
You
listen to it because you constantly listen to it, and it just seems so funny. And as a kid, I thought Stan actually sang the deep part and the voice, the woman part as well. Right, so I thought he was a great mimic. Well, you know, this is Stan singing this. Right, I didn't realise he was actually one of the Audley brothers or whoever they were. And
He just mimed it.
Yeah, he mimed it. Right, and then you've got Mary Roberts, the actress who played Mary Roberts. She did the female part.
Oh, I never knew it was her who did the female part.
Yeah, Rosalind somebody other. She did that part.
Rosalind Lawrence, that's it, wasn't it? I never knew that. Just thought, I knew it was mimicking it, but I wasn't sure who it was.
I think it's either on the Wikipedia or it's on. Yeah, you've got to take Wikipedia for what it is. If somebody's put it on there, you've got to believe it.
Have you seen the movie?
Yes. Stan and Ollie.
Stan and Ollie, yeah.
Yes, I've seen that a few times now, actually.
Because they really go into depth very well of the background and give it on back flashes of what was happening at the time and the struggles he was having.
Yeah.
But it, not a single bit of that feels reflected in the film, does it? They're both extremely professional when it comes to it.
Well, this is it. They ain't going to go around putting all the background conflict that was happening on the screen. They're just going to put out a polished professional product, and that's what they did. So people went out to watch that. If they went around putting up a bad product because of all the conflict, all the things that were going on behind the scenes, it'd just be nobody comes to watch it. They want to put it out so people will come and watch the stuff. And that Stan and Ollie movie, right, it showed what was happening, as he says, behind the scenes with Stan trying to get more of a control over his whole own productions. As we said, like he did most of the stuff on these things anyway, right? So he wanted to be able to be recognised for it. So he was trying to get it all done, and it just wasn't working because with Ollie not being exactly a willing participant in that, he had so much debt and so much gambling. So he was going from one wife to another. Well, actually, it might have been Stan's money as well, but there was no support from him, right, in that sort of way. It just didn't help themselves to be able to get this get away from Hal Roach and these contracts.
Yeah,
which is a pity because you can just imagine if Stan had got away from the studio restrictions, how much more he could have done, right? How much more control he could have done, how much better maybe even bigger budgets he could have got for his films. And just being able to put it all out, they could have been even bigger. Their movies would have been, instead of like 20 minutes shorts at 6 o'clock, they could have been like 1.5 hour length movies that had been on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evenings.
Definitely. I think he got a lot of inspiration for looking at his people who he came to Hollywood with. So you know, Chaplin took him in massively control of his films and started, United Artists.
Yeah.
And he had Buster Keaton who took total control of his films and more or less he owned it and was able to keep pumping them out as well. But I think at the time as well, Stan was looking around and looking at all these and going, well, look at these. They've got all this and I'm doing just as good.
Yeah, there probably was a bit of professional jealousy on Stan's part, trying to work out why he wasn't being given the same sort of resources, why he wasn't given more control. I can understand that. I mean, to be honest, I'm not really a big Buster Keaton fan or Chaplin. The only one I would follow would be Harold Lloyd, but that's only because his comedies was always on at the same time as Stan and Ollie's.
Exactly.
And they were just, and he's was quite inventive as well, especially compared to Buster Keaton's comedies.
When you look at Stan and Ollie, there's slapstick, there is stunts, but nothing to the massively choreographed pieces of them stood there and a house fall around them. You know what I mean? These are slapstick, which still works now.
Yeah.
Like you got Three Stooges. You've got all the way up to, I would say, Rick Mayall and Aid Edmondson in Bottom.
Yeah.
Do you remember them?
Yeah, yeah.
They're using the old, which more adult-fied, obviously, with the humour. Yeah. But that's all slapstick from these duo.
Well, this is, as you're saying, the Keaton and Chaplin, they might have gone around using these big, big, massive event-like scenarios and stuff that they were getting on screen, which looked great. But the best humour sometimes is just the simplest humour.
Exactly.
And it's just like walking across the water and falling into a sinkhole. And that happens three times during this film.
But each time I laugh, it's so funny. Much.
Each time it's funny. Right? You just don't expect it to happen, but it happens. Or you do expect it to happen, and it still happens, and you're still smiling. Right? This is the sort of thing that you like about these sort of films.
That's what I've written down. It's the, you can see the joke coming. And it's that anticipation for the joke coming around the corner. You know what I mean? Even the music more or less tells you the guys are coming on screen now, don't it?
Yeah.
something's about to happen. And there's parts within the film where you go, something's going to happen with that. Something's going to happen with that. And you think in your head, he's going to remember and it's going to bring it right the way back again. And that's the clever little touches which carry on until today. Like you said, it's tiny little comedy sketches throughout the film what they've put together.
The one of the better ones is that it's slapstick. It is slapstick. And the better ones, which I quite like, is when Stan is trying to get the locket away from around Ollie's neck, right? It's just a simple little gag, right? I mean, he just can't get it open. He's trying to stick his finger up his face, right? And then he's sticking his hand down his shirt, the back of his shirt. Then he starts pulling a little piece of a string that ultimately gets rid of poor Ollie's undergarments. Right? And I'm thinking, this is just a simple little gag that's sort of stretched out for about 2 or 3 minutes. And it's just brilliant.
But when you actually switch it on, it doesn't start like a typical Laurel and Hardy movie. Because you're instantly in the bar. You're instantly watching the girls dancing. And it does feel at that point, oh, this could be an old Western. You know what I mean? An old John Wayne Western. Like, you got all the girls dancing. And then it's got little comedy bits with the old geezer sat there with a woman on his lap. And then his missus comes in. And then it's got the guy fiddling, the barman's fiddling the manager by reckoning up with 10 cents instead of a dollar. And it's all these little touches. And that's a good 5 minutes into the film where you don't even see Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah.
Which I thought, that is unusual for one of their films. And then they come rocking up.
Yeah. But this also highlights Jane Finlinson's character, right? Because Jane Finlinson is just fantastic. He always was in all of these Laurel and Hardy comedies that he does with them. He stares to the camera. He sort of quick glance and then quick snap back and looks right at the camera again. And you're thinking, he's just brilliant. And this is the only way to highlight him, as he's a bit of a Scrooge. He's a bit of an entrepreneur showman. And then Lola's character is the showgirl out there who just wants to take whatever she can. It's just that way it gets these characters on screen, gets their little bits in before the film starts. Before Stan and Ollie and their established characters turn up to be able to carry on with the story.
It's a beautiful little setup where whoever's written it thought, right, we need to quickly establish that he's the conniving one, this is a dodgy place, and they're on the way. Yeah. And then, boom, you've got every piece in your head. You know he's the dodgy character anyway, because he always plays the dodgy character. And he was lucky because he made the transition from the silent ones as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he's one of the lucky ones what does come through, because there isn't many of the silent heroes at the time what came through to the talkies. No. Like Keaton didn't do very well.
No.
Some of the others didn't do very well either. But when you hear his voice as well, and it's that snaggy of a voice, it just complements that. The nastiness, what you want, but family orientated. You know what I mean? He's funny. Yeah. He's got the ghouly eyes as well.
Right, let's have a background on James Finlinson. James Finlinson, Scottish lad. He came over and he did. He decided he wanted to become an actor, and then he got emigrated to America, and then he got parts within the American industry in Hollywood, and he started acting and all this. He never had a moustache. That was all fake.
No,
that's a fake moustache.
Next thing you'll be saying, yours is fake.
No, this is perfectly glued on, right? And after a while, it became proper, so I can't get it off now. Gorilla glue, best thing out there. Right. Do you get kickbacks from advertising?
Yeah.
Okay, Gorilla glue, best thing out there. There you go. But when he was billed as the third part of the Lauren Hardy team, right? Really in the early part of when Stan and Ollie got together, he was the third part. It was always classed as Lauren Hardy and Finlayson, right? And then it became sort of, right, Finlayson, they realised Stan and Ollie were better as a duo. So yeah. Finlayson was sort of dropped and he became more of a character actor, but he still ended up appearing in like nearly 50 films with either Stan and Ollie.
Jesus. All right,
so he did quite well. He then, towards the end of his life, right, he came back to Britain and started acting in the movies over here. And unfortunately for him, when he's like one of the main character actors over in America in all these shorts and Stan and Ollie comedy, Yeah. A lot of his stuff, if you look on Wikipedia and on IMDb, towards the latter, it's all uncredited little bits. So I think it's just a bit of a shame that he did get more of a recognition until after he died, and then he became a lot more. There's a clip, I've seen footage of Stan and Ollie and Finlayson and Charlie Chase, I think, is the other one. And you actually see Finlayson without his moustache. It's all Stan's hair is like, they're bald. He's virtually bald. It's like a crew cut hairstyle. And I don't know what this was for, but they seem to be doing some sort of skits. It must have been like some sort of strike that had happened, and they were just doing skits on like a camera that they put together, like in somebody's back garden. But you could see Jan's Finlayson without his tosh, and you'd be able. That's why I know that he always had a fake tosh.
So let's get back. So we did the bar scene, and then we get introduced to the guys who are coming. He's poor Stan. He's having to drag Ollie, lazy git, with the donkey.
Dinah the donkey.
Exactly. Yes. See, this could also harp back to Joseph and Mary. He was dragging Ollie.
You want to go that deep, do you?
I wonder if we can go that deep that we're comparing Stan to Joseph and Ollie to Mary.
Ollie, well, you know, they've probably got the same sort of shape at that time when they were being pulled along on the donkey.
Exactly. And it's a brilliant scene where he tries to stop the cart.
the wagon, the exactly. Stagecoach, right, is coming by. It's fantastic. I mean, the thumb. He's got it folded into his hand. It's great. Right, then he takes it out. I think, oh, yeah, I should be putting that out. Uses that. Doesn't work. And then, of course, it pulls up his trouser leg and goes, flashes a bit of leg. And, of course, straight away, it suddenly stops. But these are all blokes. Even in that sort of day, would they be making this sort of joke in that sort of day? Obviously, they do.
And then they screech to a stop. And then they get squashed in. And then the typical mannerisms of which they adopt all the way through the movies is Ollie's always flustered with his tie when he's next to a woman. And yeah. He's always giggling to himself. And Stan doesn't know what to do. And his hands are all over the place. poor woman just sat there thinking of these weirdos.
Ollie thinks of himself as a woman. As a womanizer, basically. As a guy that will be able to talk to any woman about any situation, and that woman will instantly fall in love with him. That's what I think Ollie thinks of himself. Whereas poor Stan, he tries to emulate him and doesn't quite come to that sort of... and he just ends up being awkward between all of them. It's a nice scene. But the payback on that scene is obviously she finds out, as they come off the couch, her husband's waiting for him, and I like the bit where she goes, "Darling," right? And Stan thinks he's him, and she goes in for a kiss. That's you, get out of the way.
But it's loads of those little fast comedy sketches just punctuated throughout it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's like from there, they hit the famously, like you just said, they did the dance routine straight away, and then you're just. You can't stop laughing at that. And there's so many different interpretations of that now on YouTube where people drop different music behind it. Yeah. And they're just having them dancing. And it's gotten a whole new lease of life. Like I saw it on one of my son's memes. He does these memes. He puts them together himself. And he had Stan and Lolly dancing. Stan dancing on it. Yeah. I was like, do you know who they are? He was, yeah. I was like, wow.
Did he go, oh yeah, that happened to Costello. The Morecambe and Wise, I was off. Morecambe and Wise.
Ant and Dec.
Ant and Dec.
So they get it going to the bar, and there's a brilliant scene, which I love, after where he's describing to the man or the secret. And he's leaning over the desk and he's like, don't tell anyone this. And Stan's listening in like he's never heard it before.
But this is it with Stan's character. He's a simpleton, isn't he, basically? Right? Yeah. He's lovable simpleton. That's what I'll come to think of poor Stan.
Yeah. I like to think that everyone's got one of these people in their life that they know or can relate to. know what I mean? Or is it a dog again?
Dog. What's it called?
Rocky.
Rocky. After the after Stallone.
Yeah.
Jeez.
What is about that big?
What are you doing? Go on, go on.
Okay. He's all right. Yeah, it'll be okay. So sure. They got into the bar part, and then he has the conversation with the man who thinks, right, I'm gonna swindle these. I'm gonna get this money out of them. And then it breaks into yet another sing song.
But that's the best one though, isn't it?
In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the Lonesome Pine.
The trouble is, you try to reenact it as a kid, doing the voices as well.
As a kid, you ain't gonna do it. You maybe do the high pitched voice. The deep voice.
No, not at that age. No. Things haven't dropped by then, so yeah. So then we get one of the best funny whole charade of trying to find his bloody chain on his neck.
Yes, that's funny. But I've got to go back a scene, right? It's the whole thing when he keeps the deed and that's at the bottom of his shoe, right? So he's walking around, they can't find the deed, and then Stan realizes, pulls off his shoe and pulls out the deed because he's covering up a hole in the bottom of his shoe. And I think Ollie's just looking at him with disdain. There's all that little bit afterwards with the tough meat because one of the patrons goes,
I can't eat that meat. It's as tough as shoe leather.
And of course that just goes straight off in Stan's head and goes, yeah, shoe leather. Oh, I need some for the bottom of his shoe. And take some meat out of the sandwich. Puts it in his bottom of his shoe and he's walking around. But then you've got also the little bit with his toe. That's so inventive. It's so inventive because you don't think you're going to get that toe get caught up in anything. And it's just an inventive little scene with a hole in the shoe, meat, and his toe.
That toe scene as well is one of the first, I think it was the first film which made a move to more cartoonish jokes. So they started using rubber or actual drawing cartoons within the still as well. So they used the rubber for the toe. Then they've got the neck bit further on. Yeah. And then the famous lighting of the thumb as well.
Was that, I thought that was real.
I think I'm not sure how they did that bit, whether they just put some ointment on it and just lit it. You know, like when you were at school, when you just think, look, and then you have to get it off quickly before it burns you.
I think, it's just the quick little cuts as well. Because all you see is Stan trying to flick with his finger, his thumb, trying to light his thumb on light. And you just keep sitting, then you have the quick cut and you see his thumb is alight. I think that's about two. And then you see poor Ollie looking at Stan, thinking, how the hell is he doing this? It's all the looks. And it's not just looks at Stan, it's looks at the camera.
He's looking at us all the time. So he's like saying to us, did you see that? This isn't right.
It's looking at the camera.
They constantly break that wall between the audience, aren't they? Constantly throughout it. I can imagine when he came to England and he did those theatre performances, they must have been amazing. Because, you know what I mean? He gets the interaction and the laughter back, which, when he's looking at the camera, he's more or less waiting for that laughter moment, isn't he, as well?
Yeah.
The bewilderment.
Yeah, the look. Yeah. But the best one, I think, when he looks at the camera is when he goes, it's towards the end of the movie, and he puts a rope around him and goes, we'll use this wheel and whatever, the pulley to pull you up. He puts a rope around him, Stan crosses his fingers, and then looks at the camera, knowing something's going to happen. Right? And I think that is the best one out of all the looks towards the camera. It's the fingers crossed that does it.
It's brilliant. Yeah. Some of my favourite bits is Stan's got the deed down his shirt when they've come back, knowing that these two are crooks.
Yeah.
And she's tickling him on the bed. Yeah. Now, if you look closely, apparently you can see her laughing as well, because it's just, it's such an infectious laugh.
Yeah.
You can't help but laugh.
It's just, that is one of the best bits in the whole film, because not only is he laughing, we as an audience are laughing as well, because and the poor what her name is, Lola, the actress who played her, she just can't help herself, and that's why half the time her face is away from the camera, because I think she realises she's going to break, she's going to start giggling, so she turns her face away from the camera while he's got her hand down his top. And again, that's another great, it has another payoff, that scene where, you know, she's managed to get it out of his nether regions, his clothing, his garments, whatever, this deed. And he's still giggling away as he walks back into the parlour where they're all chasing each other. And Ollie gives it to him, right? And when she starts coming towards him, he realises he doesn't want to be tickled and just hands it to her. And goes, there you go. Bye-bye. I don't want it.
I've had enough.
Yeah, I've had enough. You win.
And there's a part which I think Stan it from Charlie Chaplin, the bit where he eats the hat just after that part, because Ollie turns to him and say, you said you'll get that back or eat my hat. Here's the hat. Now, I know that they had the hat made in licorice, so he could actually bite into it and chew it. But you see him like struggling with it, and then he's mentally just goes, oh well, I'm gonna have to do it. Puts his little bib on, gets his salt and pepper out, and goes to make a meal of it.
Think there as well though, he pulls the salt out of his pocket. Who carries salt in a little container in their pocket, right? To just dab on. It would be your rest of your other stuff, but no, he pulls it out of his pocket to start eating that. It's just fun. And you do see the bite marks as well in Ollie's hat later on in the scene. So it must be, this film must have been shot time order so that everything sort of married up, instead of shooting one scene and all the scenes in the saloon and then scenes elsewhere and so on. So
that's true. Yeah, because the also, if you notice the, you know, the water scene, the famous water scene, which like you said, they used three times.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, they made that. They made that water. It's an area outside LA called Sherwood Forest. They name it Sherwood Forest. It's not the actual one, but they dredged it, put all the gallons of water in, and made it so he could walk through and drop down at each point. And if you watch the very, very last scene of the cameras looking from the back of them, as Ollie drops down, the donkey, knowingly, starts walking a bit round because the hole's there and he don't want to go in the hole. And you can see Stan trying to force the donkey onto one side. The donkey's not stupid. He's like, I'm not going down there.
He's already seen Ollie falling it three times. I don't think he knows I ain't going down there. Diner, what a star.
Brilliant. Wonder if they used him later or just sent him to the glue factory.
No, don't think like that. I don't want to think like that. I know she appeared in one of their other shorts. I don't know what the name of the book. I know she was she appeared. It was a music box, I think. The one where they're trying to take the piano up the stairs.
Oh, right.
Right, so she appeared in that as well. So I don't think she must have been a star. I don't think they're going to send stars to the glue factory.
Oh, you never know. This is only like 20 years before they did Ben-Hur. And Ben-Hur, they killed horses in that. They didn't mind. They just didn't care.
I don't want to think about
shocking,
it.
Shocking.
Dinah. I think I've got a feeling Dinah lived out the rest of her life on a little farm all by herself or with her little donkey family. And she was quite happy to the end.
You know what we need to do? And you write a story of what happened to that donkey.
My story, as I've just said, she lived happily ever after. Your story, she lived a harrowing life, which resulted in her being killed off in a glue factory. So I don't think, which story do you think most people are going to go for?
Mine, because she also starts working as a whore as well.
Yeah, but mine will be uplifting all the way to the end, whereas yours will just be, oh my God, this happened to her. Oh my God, she was on the street prosying for her flipping other donkeys because she had to earn a crust. And next thing you know, she was a gangster's mall. Right, and she was vipping, and then they threatened to chop her head off and put her into a bed. Right, and all this stuff. I can't see it happening.
It is. It's great. It's like the Forrest Gump.
It won't be great. Just stick with my story. She lived a happy life on a farm.
Okay. All right. You really need to watch some of the dark films I've done. It might change your view on it.
Yes, I have listened to some of your previous podcasts, and I think, wow, Cliff. Wow, what are you watching here?
See, you could have come on done Pink Flamingo.
Yes, I could have, but I ain't.
Eat the hat. I won't do it. If you don't eat that hat, I'll tie you to a tree and let the buzzards get you.
And then he has to eat his hat. But then you think of a cracking idea. Let's go back there and nick it out of the safe because they know it's in a safe.
Yes.
So being the bumbling idiots they are, they first try getting through the door. Yes. It doesn't work because the alarm. How is the alarm?
I don't know.
How is there an alarm there? You know what I mean?
I don't know. I was
thinking.
Is there maybe a bell or something that they've attached? You know, you could maybe attach to the door. Which
it constantly
or a
just
rope
spins round. A roll yeah. one, which spins yeah. span round. Oh, maybe.
Yeah, so as soon as they walk through the door, unless you actually switch it off or turn it off, right, it's an alarm goes off. That's what I did notice that straight away. First time when I did the rewatch, thinking, what is an alarm in 1930s America? I'm not sure about that, especially on a rundown old saloon in the middle of nowhere.
It's all gas lights. That's yes. all you had to go and buy. No electricity,
candles,
or anything.
And gas lights, or there'd be thumb lighters.
Thumb lighters helped. So after this, they tried to get onto the shed, froze for the shed, and there's a brilliant double take scene, which happens in up to now comedies,
yeah.
where he's talking to Ollie. Ollie comes at the side of him, and he just looks, and then double looks, and it's used. He's used in loads of films, isn't it? It's always a double take in
yeah.
the films.
Is There's that, always whoa. A double. Well, and these pair, well, Ollie's the best of it. Right, actually, James Finlayson's quite good at it as well, because every time there was some scenes where something happened, he'd walk away and then realise something had happened, turn quite back and close his one eye and give it a bit of a squint and a scowl. That's James Finlayson's trademark. That was him back in the day.
He was perfect scowl.
Yeah, but the other scene as well, where he's pulled Ollie up and pulled him up, and then he goes, Hold on a sec while I just wet my hands or get my hands ready and put let's go of the rope. He falls to the floor, and that you can see from, I think they must have filmed it from above, that whoever it was just going bang straight onto the floor.
I know, and this wasn't a time where they used to have HR there, would they? No.
He falls, he hits the floor. He actually hits the floor. I don't know how high it was, but he just hits the floor, and you think, oh. Well, that must have hurt. But then it's also sold there as well with Stan. He's about to put. He's wondering where the hell Ollie's gone. He's looking up and going, where's he gone? And he has a look around, and then before he realises, Ollie's at his foot, at his feet, just on the floor like that. I think that's
Did
great.
You notice there's a gag there without even telling you? Because when Ollie stands up, Stan walks down. He goes down a level. Because Ollie's made such an imprint into the ground, yes. like a cartoon. You know, yeah. like the cartoons, it boom. Yeah. So he goes down a level, and I'm like, oh no. they're not even telling you about it.
No, it's just clever. It's just clever comedy. Clever comedy.
And then you've got the famous scene, which, again, I've seen it on my son's memes, where he's on the donkey, and Ollie... He says, right, get on the donkey, pull away. And then he says, you need to give me the shoes. And you can see what's coming. You think, one minute, what's going to happen? The donkey flies up into the
flying,
air.
Yes, flying diner. Oh, bless her. Right, that should be what we should write. Instead of her living on a farm, she becomes a super donkey.
Super donkey.
Super mule.
And she rescues other mules destined for the glue factory.
Well, there you go. There's our story, man.
Yeah.
Right. I'll let you write it now. Obviously, I've got too much things going on.
All right. Okay. Right, thanks, mate. No worries. And in between that, she's a serial killer and half-time
No.
whore. Yeah.
No. No.
Works no. in Mexico.
No. No. Cliff, okay. No.
Right, all right, no, okay. I will.
No.
So they luckily enough, the weight of Ollie has smashed an opening and they've got underneath like the basement side.
Yeah.
And they've gone through into the basement, and now you get to another cartoon scene of with the head.
It's so funny. It's just, yeah, I know what you're saying. When he stretches his head all the way up, as a kid, you're thinking, oh, how is that happening? You don't realise it's all cartoon. We're watching it again. Obviously, it is cartoon. It's funny. The bucket as well, when Mary walks in and goes, yeah. you've got to hide. So they put a bucket on his head. And Stan sits on the bucket with another bucket on his head, thinking that's going to be a great hiding place. It's just so silly, but so funny at the same time.
And then when he kicks the bucket, the guy, when he comes down.
But that's, yeah, that is sold as well on the fact that you see the bucket moving.
Yeah.
Just before he kicks it, the bucket's moving. So I don't know if they maybe stuck in, somebody sticking their hat, put their hand in there, just move the bucket slightly.
Or whittle it or something underneath.
Before James Finlayson walks in. And decides to kick it dead. Otherwise, poor Ollie would have had flipping. His neck would have come straight off.
Doesn't half give it a welly as
Yeah,
well.
It doesn't half give a welly. Just bad. Then straight after that, you have Stan explaining the scene. And this is done silently behind a window in this pantry, like, right? That's just great as well. Right, just going back to their silent era route and all this waving of arms and trying to explain everything to Mary.
Exactly. His exposition of how he's doing it, you can tell he's all silent on his face, and then he starts laughing himself, and you can't help but laughing because you know what he's talking about.
He's talking about the bedroom. He's just a genius, Stan Laurel. Just a genius.
It's how he keeps his face so straight. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just like gormless, poker face he's got throughout it.
He's managed to do that over a number of years working together with Ollie, right? Yeah. Or maybe even just doing his own personas in his own films. Stan knew how to sell comedy and he knew how to do it. Ollie also knew how to do it. He just didn't have the nous or the oomph to be able to create it for himself. He just needed other people to do it for him. And this is how these pair just gel together. If Hal Roach hadn't seen the potential from when they first appeared together, the first one that they were actually together as a couple is one where they
1927 or something.
Yeah, they end up kicking each other in the shins. About 100 men all kicking each other's shins, trying to flip in. I don't know what had happened. It just suddenly escalated. It was one of these little funny scenes. It's on that 21 disc box set. If you get the chance to get that 21 disc box set, it's got so much stuff on there to be able to watch.
Ollie was very ill, wasn't he? Filming one of the last films over in Italy or France at the time.
Yeah. Ollie's health deteriorated over a number of years, right? Yeah. Because he was obese. He's diabetic, I think, as well. He didn't exercise that much. I mean, he played golf, but I think most of that was probably just walking around with a paper going, well, I think that horse will win and that horse will win. Right? Yeah. So his health didn't. He wasn't there looking after himself.
But that was his. That was also his selling point, wasn't he? He was the big guy on the film. You know what I mean? So it makes you think. Even if he wanted to lose weight, in the back of him is like, well, if he lost a load of weight, he would have lost his job.
Yeah.
So you get to the point where weight is just there. So when you get to an older age where he was, and like you said, Laurel and Hardy was still playing up into the 50s over in England, you know, post-war England and stuff, and he's a big lad then. But you're at the age where you're not going to probably start going running around the track at that age, are you?
No, you're not. I mean, if you see some of his early films, he's slightly chubby. But he's actually at a decent weight. He looks
more stocky than chubby. It's like a rugby guy.
Yeah, he looks okay. And then towards the end, I mean, in this film, the belly's there. the Benny has started to come out here, and this is 38. This is like about 10 or 12 years after they were first partnered, the Benny has started to come out. And then he's in some of the later films and his later performances, he's quite a rotund bloke. Right, yeah. So his health hasn't exactly helped him, which is a pity. If he'd have maybe looked after himself, they'd have been able to complete. I think the British tour was sort of curtailed because of Ollie's health. Right, if he'd have been healthy and a lot healthier, I should say, they'd have completed that tour. Then they would have made a bigger tour in America. Right,
because and that sparked them up to get another film. Because that's what they wanted, wasn't it?
That's what Stan wanted, to get
another spark. Yeah. Because he'd written pages and pages, films and films. He'd written so much for them to do. If someone would, you know, some producer said, here's a block of money, do one of your films, it would have been there ready. Yeah.
Well, this stuff, after Ollie had died, Stan had actually carried on writing. But instead of writing for like other people, he was still writing for Stan and Ollie, the characters that they portrayed on screen. So there's about 6 or 7 years worth of stuff that he'd written up until his death, right? Yeah. Of just loads of stuff, but it was all Stan and Ollie, the TV, the movie characters that they portrayed.
Right, we're coming to the end of the film now, and they hightail it out of the kitchen. Because the guy's got his shotgun and he's aiming for him. He knows something's up. Yeah. So he sort of waits for them, doesn't he? Yeah. And they jump in a bloody piano. Of all the things to hide, they jump in a piano. And the guy's playing the piano knowing it's smashing him in the face at the same time.
What? Like, he's there with a shotgun. He's quite willing to shoot him. Why mess around playing the piano?
With a piano.
Right? It's a funny scene. And I do like it.
Right. How on earth the piano doesn't just collapse when both of them hit jump in it anyway?
I did wonder that as well. Especially now that we've just been talking about Ollie as a larger bloke.
Exactly. He's as big as the bloody piano anyway, his weight. So they had that big bit off the piano, which is another great scene. And then they running up to get the deed. The ending seems to have been wrapped up kind of fast to the point where it makes me think they said, look, we're going over an hour now. Yeah. We need this to be done.
Yes.
Because they grab the guy, they hang him up. Yeah. So it's like, he's gone. The woman's running around, not knowing what's happening. They grab the deed. They got the lady whose deed it is out of there on the donkey. And then they're out of the town.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're thinking, there is such a long route to get to that main bit of them getting the money, and then it's boom, over. You know what I mean? It felt like a short.
Well, because you got to wonder if they cut anything out, right? So maybe there were gags in there that they might have cut out. Because from what I've read, the UK print had about 3 minutes of extra footage, including a scene when, you know, when they come across that the sign that says Deadwood Gulch right at the beginning of the film. And this is just only 2 miles in that direction. But apparently, there's a whole scene with that sign where the wind's just blowing in all different directions. So you don't know which way it is. But that's clever. That was in the... They're saying that was in the British cut and it wasn't in the US cut. So there's about 3 minutes worth of footage that available on this than in other countries.
Now that our troubles are over, where do we go from here?
They've got out the film now. They've got away. They've had their fun. But there's some great lines when Stan and Ollie have just met Lola and Jane Finlayson's character. We've got a deed, right, from your great uncle, and he died. She says,
tell me about my dear, dear daddy. Is it true that he's dead?
Well, we hope he is. They buried him.
It's just a simple line, right? Stand by stand, right? And I was peeing myself over that.
It just shows how much of a simpleton it is, because he follows it up straight away. And she said, what did he die off? And he goes, I think it was a Tuesday. Or was it a Thursday?
So you think of Stan and Ollie with their slapstick, but they come out with these little lines in the whole film as well. Right, and you just think, that's brilliant. There's another one. They're walking out of the room and Stan turns around.
Now that you've got the mine, I bet you'll be a swell gold digger.
Right, and I was thinking, what? Right, he's just already, He's already thought of the word that describes her in real life, but he just thinks that she's a lovely woman.
There's a few beautiful lines in this. There's one right at the end when it goes,
"Are you from the South?"
"I sure am."
"Well, fan my brow. I'm from the South."
"You are?"
"Mm-hmm."
"Well, shut my mouth. I'm from the South, too."
"South of what, sir?"
"The South of London."
And he wasn't. It was from Cumbria, wasn't he? Yeah. But in America, they only know London. That's it.
Then he goes on with with fish and chips.
Yes, that's it.
Fish and chips. Oh, it's just lovely. It's just lovely, this film. It's just absolutely lovely. People can dig this film out. I don't know where they're going to find it. I don't know if it's available.
There's a free one on YouTube.
There you go. Yeah. Just dig it out. Have a watch on there. It's just fantastic, just lovely. You'll sit there, it's an hour long, and you'll just enjoy every minute of it.
Yeah, it's a good laugh, and it's carefree, it's family orientated. You stick your family in front of it, you know, you can watch it, and there's no hang-ups, it just makes you happy.
Yeah.
It's happy stuff, there's no sad stuff.
And then once you've watched this film, then you've got to go on to start watching some of their other stuff. And You don't have to watch the feature length ones, the ones that were like an hour or an hour and a half. You just go watch the 20 minute ones, and 20 minutes in a day is nothing. And you can sit and watch. I think there's about 50 or 60 that is on this 21 disc box set. Right, you can watch one of these a day, and that'll keep you going for at least 2 months, and they will just always bring a smile to your face.
There's some out there, some great little stories what they've done, and there's one in particular which I always remember where Stan gets a knock on his head and he remembers he's like the Earl or some great person in the UK, and it was one of the first ones where I think he traveled to the UK in that one or something, and it's a brilliant little story. But the stories of Laurel and Hardy, you know, if you watch them and you watch like Sookie says, watch some of the shorts, some of the latest films what you've watched now, and some comedies from the 80s and 70s, you'd be like, that's where they got the idea from.
Yeah.
That's where they did that from. Because it's copies of them. It's the perfect comedy duo of all time.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the stuff was originated in the silent era.
Yeah.
But and then they used it again in this the talkies. And a lot of these, as you said, Cliff, a lot of these people these days can go back to Stan and Ollie, to Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd, and just pick up so many ideas from their era and just utilise them in their films. They just would be fantastic. Yeah. Well, Mr. Bean, as you said, Rowan Atkinson, Mr. Bean.
Well, Mr. Bean was so massively, massively successful around the world simply because they more or less copied the silent era.
Yeah.
It's all the daft stuff throughout it. I think we've come to the end of the pod, and I don't know if you're aware, but you must have because you've heard the pods. But
now,
you get to pick a song.
Do I get to pick a song?
Yes, you get to pick a song. Do you want one from the film or one of your own?
Now we'll have the
you
we'll
singing.
we'll definitely have the one from the film.
No problem. I'll put Lonesome Pine on. So thank you very much, Sookie.
No worries, man. It's lovely being on here. I've broken my ship's deep dive duck, as they say.
That's it now. You've got that list. Come on again.
Well, that list. Oh, let me think. Yeah, I'll think of something. Don't you worry.
Nice one. Take care, mate.
No worries. Thank you.
On a mountain in Virginia stands a lonesome pine. Just below is the cabin home of a little girl of mine. Her name is June, and very, very soon she'll belong to me. For I know she's waiting there for me neath that lone pine tree. In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome pine, in the pale moonshine, our hearts entwine, where she carved her name and I carved mine. Oh June, just like the mountains are blue, like the pine, I am lonesome for you.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome pine, in the pale moonshine, our hearts entwine, where she carved her name and I carved mine. Oh June, like the mountains, I'm blue, like the pine, I am lonesome for you.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome